Just a very minimalist little sting there. The Crates of Atmosphere. Peter, there's another dimension to your new novel, The Chemistry of Tears. You're collaborating on the project with the American artist John Kessler, who's with us. He's on the phone. Now, you wrote a catalogue essay in his 2004 exhibition, The Global Village Idiot. Tell us about him before we meet him.
Oh, Kessler, are you there? Why aren't you here? Anyway, John is the most extraordinarily inventive, political, social artist, but I mean he's just a mad artist, really, who puts together visual images which feed back on other visual images which feed back on us and life and the world. The world of oil spills is his world. The world of Iraq is his world. He makes works of complication and wonder and joy, and which continually measure with the greatest sort of mechanical detail the way this thing turns on something else and the way that little camera looks at that and turns that into a surprising work of art. You can live with his work for a long, long, long time.
Yeah.
And he's a great guy.
He's represented in major galleries. He's also a professor of visual arts at Columbia University. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
How did you guys meet?
Well, I think we originally met through Peter's friend, Paul Oster, my brother-in-law, and that was probably 15, maybe even, probably when Peter just moved to New York, and we got to know each other then, and he's come to my shows, and then there was a time when Peter's son, Charlie, was actually working for me in my studio as my assistant. So we've had an ongoing, friendship and relationship, and this will be the first time that we're actually going to collaborate on something.
Let's give the listener a sense of some of the work you've done. You often create large video installations with a strong emphasis on security cameras are a theme for you. Give us a sense of how a gallery goer would experience one of your works.
Well, I like to say that I make films in real time. So you walk into a kind of crazy installation with as many as 60 cameras, hundreds of monitors, and you are a voyeur, you're an exhibitionist, you are caught in the surveillance target, you are looking at, on the screens, you're looking at someone who might be in another room or, you know, across the gallery from you, and usually what there are, the cameras are shooting through photographs which have punctures, holes in them, and you see multiple images and even the real and the represented all coming together in the image. So it's a kind of, it's a blur of the mediated and the real in my work.
Now one installation I've been looking at online, you create the experience of being inside an army tent and the viewer becomes a kind of witness to violence. This is called Kessler Circus, which actually I thought sounded like a place in a Peter Carey novel. Can you talk to me some more about that work?
Sure. It's actually, the title comes from one of the great assemblage sculptures of all time, Calder Circus, which is in the Whitney Museum. It's in the permanent collection. And it's meant to be playful and at the same time incredibly scary. And it's really about, yes, it's all housed under a used army tent that I got on the internet, and it's really it's the political idea behind the piece is after watching us move into Iraq and Afghanistan, it's about this sort of dropping down of the sort of all the sort of necessary ingredients of creating democracy, even to the point of ramming it down people's throats. And so it's mechanized horror. There's sort of some very beautiful, joyful images as well, but most of it is playful, and at the same time, you walk out shaking, hopefully.
Yeah, because the politics is pretty hard hitting, isn't it, in that one?
Yeah, it is. Not every installation is that blunt, but that is probably one spectrum of the kind of work I make.
John, I know you live close to the World Trade Center. That must shape the worldview of everyone who lives in that vicinity.
Oh, yeah. I mean, my daughter was actually in school two blocks away from the World Trade Center, and she was evacuated, and then she had to go. They had to find a new school for her. During that time, I was going back and forth to Columbia, and I was having to show identification. I had three checkpoints that I'd have to show on the way, to come home every day.
And are you... is that where it starts for you, the politics, or does the politics go back earlier than that?
The politics actually start for, in my work was not political all through the 80s and the 90s, and it was really, I would say, I can honestly attribute George Bush to the anger and the fury that the work took on, you know, in the beginning of the 2000s, and it was literally just watching, you know, it was almost like. A Henry Fonda movie or something, where the wrong man, it was just like all of a sudden I found myself, as many of us did, you know, in a country that was being taken away, that wasn't ours anymore. And it was just, the anger just was mounting. And it actually just, it was almost like a dam that broke, and it came out in the work. I was always making mechanical sculptures. I was always focused on making things move and having a certain kind of simple mechanism that was creating a representation that was larger than the actual thing itself, like the man behind the curtain. But all of a sudden, the work just started taking on much more of a political tinge.
Mm-hmm. So you've now entered into a collaboration with Peter. Whose idea was this?
Peter's.
Peter's.
Probably.
Well,
yeah. I mean,
it was Peter's.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, Peter, it was like a hot potato, you know. Peter threw up a hot potato, and he offered me to catch it, and I did, and I threw it back. And, yeah, go ahead.
I work at Hunter College in New York, where I run the creative writing program there, and they were very excited that the writers in the program and other people should collaborate across the arts, and so there was some. You know, serious pressure applied. Yeah, they go, who would you like to collaborate? What would you like to do? And the only person I could really think that I would be honored and excited to do something with was John. But I was very tentative about asking him because, I mean, he does what he does really well without any help from me. And this book, The Chemistry of Tears, became a little bit of an excuse because John was a very important advisor on the book. He read the manuscript. It hadn't occurred to me that actually what he made really were automata in a way, even though I'd liked his work. And he said, "Oh yes." So he was an expert in the history of automata. He helped me in all sorts of ways, and so he was sort of softened up a little bit for the moment when I said, "Would you like to do? Could we do something together?"
And John, is that how you saw it?
Yeah, I mean, really, what Peter gave me a lot of freedom in designing the show, and it was really, and he just said, keep going, and I'd sort of throw out ideas, and then I'd get these sort of, you know, late night emails with YouTube links and excerpts from passages from the book, and it just sort of happened. It just, you know, I mean, we're I'm sure, like all of my work, it changes when we install or when it gets closer or when I start building it. But I'm going to be using quite a few existing sculptures that I've already made, and some actually go back to the 80s, late 80s. But most of them. Most of them already exist, and others will be added just because, like, the Deep Water Horizon piece, which is, you know, this incredible video, which is, you know, it's surveillance video from deep, deep, deep under the sea of this open open pipe and the oil just, you know, emerging. And that's something that I'm really excited about actually making. And I'll make it with smoke and mirrors and really simple means and found objects and tin cans and whatever, but with lighting and, with special, like, low-tech special effects, it should look quite a bit like the video that, you know, one would see on YouTube.
Peter Carey, it sounds to me as though John's planning to embrace the politics of all this, and the politics was an aspect that you were sort of keeping at arm's length.
In what sense?
Well, when we were discussing, you know, what the writer does, you were emphasizing...
No, I was talking about... Sorry.
You're emphasizing playfulness and ambiguity and so on, and yet...
Yeah. Well, firstly, I'd say that ambiguity can be playful and lighthearted, and that can be darker and more mysterious. The only thing I was really talking about, Michael, I think, is that I really didn't want my characters to be mouthpieces for, you know, some sort of soapbox position on something. But I really wanted my, I would want my novel to sort of inhabit the same political world that John inhabits, yeah. and John's head, and where John's head is. So it's all there if you want to look at it. We're just different people doing different things, but we're swimming in the same polluted, poisonous water, and our responses to the polluted, poisonous water is pretty much the same, I think.
For me, Peter, the challenge here is that politics reduces everything to two sides, to, you know, bland slogans and ideologies that are just far too crude as real descriptors of the complex world. And finding a way in the public sphere where you can actually state the way in which the world works without creating villains on one side and virtue on the other, and only, you know, those two camps. That seems
I think just embedded in the history of the automaton is a sense of anxiety and a sense of fear. I mean, it's, you know, I mean, the fact is, you know, Pierre Jacques Droz, who was, you know, one of the masters, the Swiss masters, he was a clockmaker, and the automatons that he made were actually advertisements for his watches. But he was imprisoned when he showed them in Spain. The Inquisition imprisoned him. I mean, there's always been a sense of fear that, you know, in some ways we will be replaced.
And what was the offense? You know, what was the offense that got him in prison? Why is that such a bad thing to do?
Oh, because it's taking away the power of God. I mean, that was, you know, in you know, to create life. I mean, it was you know, there's always been this power and this anxiety in the automaton, which is that it gets incredibly close, and, you know, to real life, and that's where it actually sort of the uncanny takes over. But there's always been a sense of, you know, fear and wonderment in the sort of the advanced clockmaking of automatons. And it's you know, as you get closer to the divine, to something that is actually sort of, you know, a form of creation.
Which brings us back, Peter, to where you were saying was a kind of starting point for you with the book.
Well, where I began with the book was the notion of the internal combustion engine. And for a long time, my working title was either Internal Combustion or My Internal Combustion, which sort of seemed to apply to Catherine a little bit.
So what happened to the internal combustion engine? You left with a mini miner and...
No, it's sort of the thing that happens with a novel, there's a line that goes through this novel which would represent, I suppose, more or less what I knew or what I thought I knew. And you could represent that by saying the internal combustion engine was invented by someone, and the end result of the internal combustion engine is the planet is being destroyed. And that no longer seems a hysterical thing to say. And I could have different people looking at that, and particularly Amanda, and who has an idea that the automata contains the elements of the internal combustion engine. And that's a sort of a line of thought. Now, I go in like that, but then I find out the great joy of writing novels is not writing a thesis and not constructing an argument so much, but you finding out all of these other things. And so when I went into the novel and suddenly I have this woman who's grieving for a dead lover, and I'm thinking about the nature of life and death and loss and what makes us feel and what makes us do these things, I'm starting to think about science, our great certainty in what we know, and the way historically we're always wrong about what we know. I'm sure we are at this very moment thinking in some way or other that the sun goes around the earth and we're wrong again. So finding out all of those sorts of things, and so it becomes, as I said before, it's like one maybe might like to imagine a really sort of big, beautiful painting that was full of stuff to look at and wonder about for a long time.
John Kessler, when will we be seeing this collaboration?
The hope is that it's going to be, we were trying to time it with the book release in the States of Peter's book, but it looks like it'll probably be happening in the fall now, which is better because there'll be a lot of people around. There'll be, you know, all the students will be back, and the gallery, we're going to do it at the Hunter Gallery, the Hunter College Gallery, so there'll be a lot of people to see it.
Well, it sounds like a real treat. John Kessler, thank you for joining us. It's been lovely to meet you.
Thank you very much.
Good on you. John Kessler there, joining us on the line from New York, telling us about the collaboration that he's embarked on with our guest this morning, who's Peter Carey, who's written a new book. It's called The Chemistry of Tears.